Good morning. You are listening to The Beacon. Saturday morning to you all and to you. I'm pointing to you, Brian Hawkins.
Happy Saturday to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. How are you?
I feel fine. It's just that I have a little tooth problem.
What's going on?
Well, you know those little dental things that you get? You can floss your teeth with it and, you know, clean in between your teeth.
Like the water sprayer or floss?
No, it's like floss. Those little plastic...
like the sticks with the floss?
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm, sure.
So I was interacting with one of those.
That's never good.
And, I don't know. For some stupid reason, I started chomping down on the plastic part.
Oh.
And I broke my tooth.
Sure. Really?
Yes, and so it has like a jagged edge, and I haven't been able to eat, so...
Does it hurt?
No, the tooth doesn't hurt, but my tongue keeps cutting itself on it.
Ryan, which tooth is it? I don't see it.
It's a molar.
Oh, my gosh. So how come you can't eat? Can you eat on the other side?
Well, when I swallow and also when I chew, the tongue gets cut on the tooth. So I've been eating like things that you could don't necessarily have to chew a whole lot.
So you're on a soft food diet, basically.
Basically.
You might as well have just had your jaw broken.
Right. So after this broadcast, I should be all fixed up.
Okay. Are you going to the dentist?
Of course.
And what do they do for something like that? They put
I have
a crown
no idea.
On it or something?
But this dentist is highly
recommended.
Trained.
Okay. Sorry.
Well.
That's too early for a segue. It's too early for a segue. Let's walk it back.
Too early
walk
for a segue. Back. You segue early, often, and late.
And always.
But yeah, that's where I am. So,
I'm
but
sorry.
Other than that, I am the picture of health.
I'm so glad. You
yes.
look it.
Yes.
You don't look like you're being bothered by a sore tooth. But
No.
You hide it well.
Me watching all those Westerns. I'm a manly man.
You,
so.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what I think of you.
That's right.
Western Brian.
Uh-huh. Every Saturday morning, get up, have my beans, coffee, and bacon, and I'm ready.
Do you grind your own coffee? Do you do like a French press?
I do have a grinder.
I
that's
bet
the best
you.
Way to have it, I think.
Yeah.
Because it's really fresh and it tastes really good.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. I got a Verismo for Christmas. I might have talked about this on the air because I was so excited about it.
No, I don't remember.
Okay. It's an espresso machine by an unknown, very popular coffee company. But it was Christmas. I got it for Christmas, and we're less than 4 months out, and it's already giving me problems. So
what is it doing or not
doing?
Well,
it's telling me that I need to descale it. So it's telling me I need to descale it, which means, so it's one of those pod machines. And it's, so when that happens, you get the water stays, you know, kind of in a, why, I can't think of words today. Words elude me today.
That's bad when you're in radio.
It is,
on
when
the
you
air.
Have to talk for a living and you can't think of words. Anyway, the water stays in the machine through the tubes. And so the tubes develop they develop a scale. They develop like kind of a line buildup. And so every couple of months, the coffee machine tells you to descale it. So I got the little message that I needed to descale it last month, so I did, and then it worked okay for like a month, and then I got the message again that I needed to descale it, so I did, and then the descaling message has not gone away. So I'm a little...
But does it still work otherwise?
It does, but I don't know for how long. Like, because the first time it told me to descale, it wouldn't spout coffee until like it was satisfied that it had been descaled. Now it's still like filtering the coffee, but I don't know how long. I just feel like I feel like something is off with it. So
it's a sensitive machine.
It's a sensitive machine. I'm feeling like it's on its last legs, and I've only had it for 4 months, and I'm just not happy, Brian. I'm just not happy.
You didn't do it right.
I did it right. Don't blame me.
Just put yourself a Mr. Coffee.
I know. I had one, and it was
grinder.
Great.
There
right?
you go.
That's all you need. I did, and then I tried to upgrade to the fancy stuff, and look what happens.
So yeah.
Keep it simple, friends. That's the moral of this story.
That's the moral.
I know.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you.
I know. I'm not looking for advice. I'm just venting. That's why we're here, right?
That's good. I have no advice.
Get it out. So I had an experience yesterday, or maybe it was 2 days ago, that I need to get off my chest again. And I just didn't know how to handle it. So I interpret at a hospital, and oftentimes they'll have multiple patients on the floor that require interpreters, whether it's sign language or Spanish or another spoken language. So when we're not actively interpreting, they have us sit in a specific area, just kind of off the, you know, off the floor. And I, you know, I'm very much an introvert when I'm in those environments. I usually bring work to do, or I bring books to read, or I bring emails to write. Like, I bring something to do because I know oftentimes there will probably be some downtime. So I'm not looking to engage in some, like, big rhetoric and 2 hours of dialogue with a stranger. Just not.
Not ready for
that. It's not my jam. It's not my jam. So I was at this hospital the other day, and I was, you know, there was another interpreter there, and I went to sit down and went to go put my headphones in, because that's what I do. That's my trick, right? You put your headphones in so nobody talks to you. And he caught me before I was able to get the headphones in.
Mid-headphone.
Like, they were going up, and then he started chatting, and I was like, oh, man. So, which is, it's fine. But what happened was this gentleman was very kind of aggressive with his body language and his way of speaking. And we're on a small couch, so I don't have a whole lot of space. And he's kind of leaning in toward me, but then he started turning to politics. And he started saying things that were very hot button political topics, which, I'm sorry, but when you first meet somebody, there's just some conversations that you don't bring up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So he started saying things to me that I legitimately started getting mad about.
What?
He said to me, the Parkland students need to stop talking because they're talking from a place of ignorance. The Parkland students are obviously the high school that experienced the mass shootings back in February.
So he's a gun enthusiast.
I don't know. I don't know what his deal was. I have no idea. It took everything I had to not get up and just walk out of the room. And I did. And I turned to him and I said, we cannot talk about this. I vehemently disagree with you. And this is like, this is really, this topic is very, I don't know. I don't remember specifically what I said, but I basically told him that we could not talk about it because I was in great disagreement.
So do you expect to see this guy ever again?
No, I don't.
Well, you could have been a lot ruder.
I could have been, but you know me. Like, that's not in my DNA. Like, I could have for sure said some choice words to him, but I don't do that to people because then I just feel guilty about it. But then he didn't stop. Thank God I was called in to go interpret for my patient, so I was able to leave the situation. And by the time I got back, he was gone. And he had left a note for me saying that he apologized. He apologized for upsetting me. With a busy... So he leaves this note that says, I'm so sorry that I upset you. That's never my intention. Check me out on YouTube. And then he left his card. And he's like a comic, like a comedian on YouTube. I don't even know. It was so bizarre, Brian. The whole turn of events was so bizarre. And here I am.
Sounds like it.
Right? And here I am 2 days later still kind of reeling from the whole thing. But it was just a very...
He left a note.
It was very considerate.
He was just probably hitting on you. You have to expect that.
I mean, is that how guys hit on women these days?
Guys who don't know how to hit on women.
Oh my gosh. That's a sad state of affairs, if I do say so myself.
Well, he writes notes.
Yes, he does. Which is sweet. That's kind of old school romance, right? I better leave a note on my business card.
This will straighten it all out.
So that was the excitement of my week. That's all I have to report back for today.
Not much going on
for the slow week in the world of Laney.
Well, you should have been around the lighthouse because there's a lot going on around the lighthouse.
Ooh, do tell.
Yes, as a matter of fact, the lighthouse is involved with a very important, very interesting research project in collaboration with the Illinois Institute of Technology and other institutions. Now, this is regarding the intracordial visual prosthesis device. That's a mouthful.
That is a mouthful.
And what that does, it compensates for blindness by stimulating the visual centers within the brain. So Dr. Philip Troik and Dr. Francis Lane of the Illinois Institute of Technology will be along to make all of that make sense to us.
To the layperson.
Yes.
To the civilian.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank goodness. And they're locals, too. So that's always nice.
Yes,
it is. Having locals on this show. I don't know.
And they've been by before. So this
cool.
is a return engagement.
Lovely.
So we'll find out about that research. And, of course, The Awe Factor, which I'm guessing is an opposite story than from what you just told us.
Yes, I had to go immerse myself in my Awe Factor archives in order to kind of wash that situation off of me. Uh-huh. But yes, I do have a nice story for us today.
We're going to come back and get everything started on the other side of this break. This is Lainey Kleeman.
Hi.
Brian Hawkins.
There you are.
On the Beacon here on WCPT 820 AM.
Hi, everyone. This is Alex Trebek, the host of Jeopardy. If your question is, how can someone who is blind enjoy the latest magazine writing and not have to pay a penny? Then the answer is Choice Magazine Listening. Every other month, we'll send you hours of stimulating, unabridged articles, short stories, and poetry from writers such as Russell Baker, Derek Walcott, Joyce Carol Oates, Bill Moyers, and Margaret Atwood. These free special speed cassettes are sent to anyone unable to read because of physical limitations. If you're interested, write today to Listening, Box 10, Port Washington, New York, 11050. We'll also tell you how to get the necessary free Library of Congress talking book player. So write Listening, Box 10, Port Washington, New York, 11050. Or call 516-883-8280. That's 516-883-8280. Thank you.
Well, the Lighthouse is always working on new and exciting research projects and different informational sessions for individuals who are blind, visually impaired, disabled, or veterans. And today I am speaking with a group of distinguished guests, Drs. Philip Troik and Dr. Francis Lane from the Illinois Institute of Technology. And, you know, about a month ago, we had an educational session on the intracortical visual prosthesis. This is a device that the Lighthouse is currently collaborating with, in addition to Illinois Institute of Technology, University of Chicago, and Johns Hopkins, and other institutions. Dr. Troik and Dr. Lane, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Wonderful. Well, you know, on March 1st, we had an educational session about this intracortical visual processes, and I know that the purpose of it right now is to inform individuals who might be interested in it. Could you tell us more about the educational session? We will get more into details about the device itself, about the research, but could you tell us about the education session?
Sure, that's a really great question, Sandy. So the purpose of the educational session is to make sure that the constituency of the Lighthouse, the readership that you all have of people who are blind, understand the device itself. The purpose right now is not to recruit for the actual study itself for implantation. Mm-hmm. And the purpose for this really is because over time we've learned that the information is incredibly complex and is difficult to process. And so individuals really need time to hear the information, digest it, ask questions, read it again. And so this educational component is really to, again, like I said, make sure that the individuals who are blind in the Chicagoland area really develop an understanding of what the expectation should be for the device, what the investigators believe it will do, how the vision system works, things of that nature.
And, you know, I was there at the presentation, and the room, from what I could tell, you know, it was crowded. You know, so people are wanting to learn more about this new technology. And as you mentioned, Dr. Lane, you also covered, you know, the workings of the visual system, which is a very complex topic. Going into, you know, bits of the educational session, how does the visual system work?
So the vision system is an extremely eloquent organization of neural networks in our brain.
Sure.
And light enters into our eye, falls on the retina, and from there it is converted by the photoreceptors into a volley of neural impulses that leave the eye through the optic nerve mm-hmm. and eventually reach what's called the primary vision cortex, which is located in the back of your head, just above your neck. And if you put your two hands on the back of your head, kind of where it joins the neck, that's where the vision cortexes are, one on each side. Mm. So the eyes actually, the information splits and goes to both halves of the brain. And when that information, that neural information, reaches the brain then has to decode it. And then through a very complicated operation of neural machinery in the brain, your brain actually creates the perception that we call vision. So we don't have a little TV tube in our head when little person in our head watching to see what's going on. Instead, the brain creates a perception mm-hmm. of the world around us as this information comes in optically through our eyes. And it's really amazing in all species, particularly humans, in the amount of information we get from that.
You know, and I have to say, Dr. Troik, I am amazed that you were able to explain that, you know, because in a few minutes, because I know the vision system, it's very complex. You know, it can take us hours to really understand how it works and how we as humans perceive the world.
Yeah, I think it's important to realize that because we're each unique mm-hmm. and each of our brains is unique, yeah. that means each of our perceptions is unique. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when two people see the color red, how do they know it's red? Right. They know it's red because somebody told them one time it was red, yeah. But they don't share the same perception. And so, you know, if we think of artists, for example, who have a way of creating things on a canvas based on what they see or what they perceive or even what they remember they've perceived, we can appreciate that each of us with our different perceptions means that we can't share those perceptions directly. We can communicate them, but we can't share them. So the brain of everyone is unique, and it's a very complicated set of neural machinery, and it's that neural machinery that the intercortical vision prosthesis will attempt to actually tap into.
Now, you know, that leads in perfectly into the prosthesis itself. First of all, I introduced you both earlier, but could you tell us a little bit about how you are involved in the research?
Well, I'm not a medical doctor, but I play one on TV. No.
I love that.
I'm a biomedical engineer
sure.
With a background in electrical engineering, but in the field of biomedical engineering, you have to wear many hats, mm-hmm. and so we become mm-hmm. neuroscientists. We become wannabe neurosurgeons. We have to look at a broad range of different of capabilities and skills that have to be brought to bear on this. And, you know, Frank, maybe you'd like to say a little bit about your background and how we got together.
So at IIT, I'm a professor in the Department of Psychology with an emphasis on rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. And so my involvement in this project dates back to 2008 when Dr. Troik asked a question, which is how would individuals who are blind respond to a vision prosthesis? And Margaret Hike, who was then a professor in psychology, and I started a series of focus groups here at the Lighthouse where we started asking individuals who are blind what they thought sure. And what their expectations would be and what would some of the benefits be. And so what we did was learn an incredible amount about the perspectives of people who are blind, and really the project from the perspective of a participant has really evolved based on the information that we learned from individuals here at the Lighthouse. So it makes perfect sense for us to be here and working through the Lighthouse, through this project, because of the work that we've done and the collaboration that we've done over time. But with my background, my role is very much looking at how do we, again, educate individuals, but also what kind of information goes into an informed consent process at the point at which we're actually recruiting individuals for the study. What are appropriate benefits and expectations? How well adjusted is someone to their blindness? We've learned that these are factors that are really important before we even entertain someone as a potential recipient of the implant.
And it's really wonderful to have the Lighthouse as a partner in this. I think it's somewhat unique among projects like this because there are other projects for visual perception restoration using technology. Mm-hmm. But we are really fortunate to have the Lighthouse because the Lighthouse really can form an epicenter of not only the outreach that we're doing today, but eventually when we do recruit, the actual testing of the volunteers who receive the implants will be done at the Lighthouse.
No, and you know, we've always been part of the groundbreaking technology that's being developed in other areas, assistive technology. And so now being the part of this groundbreaking project, you know, it's definitely, we're glad to have you as part of our team as well. Now, I know that this device, you know, it's not like it was designed, you know, within a couple of years, or the research began within a couple of years. I know that it's been going on for at least 15 years. Is that correct?
Well, it actually dates back a lot earlier than that. Mm-hmm. The roots of this project date back to the early 1970s.
Wow.
At the National Institutes of Health.
Sure.
And at that time, there was an initiative to study and research how one could feasibly implant an electronic system that would communicate artificial vision information directly to the brain. And so over the decades, the National Institutes of Health funded fundamental work. It then funded developmental work. There was one implantation done in a volunteer who had a small number of electrodes placed in their brain for stimulation. And from all this, we eventually learned what the pathway to feasibility was. And so for our project, starting in about 2000, mm-hmm. The NIH de-emphasized their internal research on this and transferred this type of work to external entities, of which then we became the inheritors of the original work. So the basic principle here is that by using a very tiny electrodes that are then inserted into the vision cortex area of the brain, that a small electric currents can be put in, which would then stimulate the nerve cells and then create the perception of vision by taking a artificial image from a camera, electronic camera, converting it to signals, which then turn into currents, which then stimulate the nerves, which are then in the vision area. So we're really looking to try to, modulate the perception of vision that we already have inherent in our brain with this artificial link that bypasses the eyes and goes directly to the brain.
And that was a great explanation about how the device works, which was actually my next question. But could you explain the device itself? You know, now that our listeners heard that, they're probably wondering, like, you know, how big is the device? How will it go into the brain?
Yeah, so the term device is actually a bit misleading. Uh-huh. Because it's really a system.
Okay.
And the system is made of a small collection of modules, each of which are about the size of the tip of a pencil eraser.
Hmm.
So if you imagine a pencil eraser where you just sort of sliced off a small tip of it, and you hold that in your hand.
Right.
And then imagine that protruding from that are microscopic electrodes, 16 of them, that are so small that the tips of those electrodes, you could put about 5 to 10 on the tip of a human hair. So these are extremely small electrodes that just barely penetrate the brain in the region where the nerve cells are.
Sure.
And these little electrodes protrude from this little pencil eraser type thing, kind of like looking like a little miniature hairbrush, if you think of that.
Wow.
And so a collection of these modules, each of which talks to 16 electrodes, is then implanted as a group, and then that makes up an ensemble of these, which then makes up what we refer to as the device. But really, it's a collection of these little miniature modules, which are called wireless floating microelectrode arrays.
Now, is the camera, is that an external device? You mentioned the camera earlier.
Yes. So the only thing that's implanted are the little eraser, pencil eraser type modules.
Sure.
Each one of those modules is wirelessly powered and communicated with, kind of like a little cell phone network that would
sure.
be in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a external device that's maybe like the thin size of a thin hockey puck. That would be placed directly over the area where the devices are. And then we can power and communicate with them wirelessly, and we can call up each device. It has its own phone number. And we can call up each electrode. It has its own phone number or street address. And we can tell them what to do. So the camera would be placed probably on a pair of glasses that would be placed on the volunteer's head,
sure.
or possibly on a headband or somewhere else that would be convenient. And then the electronic signals from the camera are converted into the control signals, which are then wirelessly communicated to the small implantable devices.
Wow, that's pretty amazing, you know, just to picture all of that. Now, you know, I do want to emphasize to our listeners that you are currently not recruiting participants for the study. This is solely for education purposes. But when the recruiting starts, who will be eligible to participate?
Well, in any of these types of devices, whether they've been for cochlear implants
sure.
for hearing or implants for restoration of movement of paralyzed muscle, one tends to recruit people who have the more extreme cases of the condition
sure.
that one is interested in trying to alleviate. So in our case, right now, the actual recruitment and enrollment protocols have not been finalized,
uh-huh.
but we anticipate that the ideal candidate would be someone who had had sight, so they have acquired blindness, and that they would currently have little to no light perception. And they would be what one would call a totally blind
mm-hmm.
or having no light perception, although we figure that that may be difficult to achieve because most people have some sort of perception that they experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me being one of them on a personal note, you know. So, you know, approximately when would the implantation begin, or, you know, when would the next process of the research begin?
Well, we don't have a timetable yet,
uh-huh.
a specific timetable, because right now the state of our project is that after many decades of research,
sure.
we've been fortunate enough to receive a large grant from the National Institutes of Health under the Brain Initiative.
Sure, sure.
And this grant is now funding two phases of the project.
Uh-huh.
The first is what's called a preclinical phase, where we're doing safety testing of the device,
sure.
regulatory testing,
sure.
getting FDA approval for the device, and then eventually approval at the institution where it'll be implanted, which would be University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Once those are in place, then we can prepare for the recruitment process. So according to a rough timetable, that may be occurring within the next 2 years, but it's uncertain because
sure.
we have to get all the safety testing and the regulatory approvals in place first.
Great.
I can tell you about the the timetable for the educational component, which is currently going on. The next informational session is scheduled for July the 28th, and then we plan on having a third session in December of this year. And in addition to those sessions, we will also have articles in the both the E-Beam as well as the Beam, as well as this interview here. And so the idea is not that we'll continue to present the same information over and over, that this is really designed to be an iterative process so that as individuals who attend the session ask questions and we learn what kinds of information is really not only relevant but important to the individuals who are blind who are considering or will consider this device at some point, that we include that information in subsequent sessions. But we're also, after the sessions, contacting the individuals in those sessions and asking them questions to see how well they understood the material, if there's something that we need to do to tweak the way we present the information to facilitate understanding better. And so so this is a really important component of the project over this next year, so that it really teaches us how to best present information. The other piece of it is that we started a conversation with the Lighthouse, or at the Lighthouse, back in 2008, and we've continued that conversation over time. And I think that the educational component isn't just us presenting information and assessing how well individuals receive it, but also that we take that information and that it continues to inform the project, because the investigators pay very close attention to the information that we have received and continue to receive from the intended recipients. And that's a really significant and important component of this project, which is that the end user of the technology has been at the forefront of our thinking as the project itself evolves. And this is whether we're talking about biomedical engineers or biologists, everyone has paid attention to the information that we gather. So that's what the timeline looks like over the next year. So individuals can hear about it if they come to the session, but they can also read about it if they can't attend by way of the newsletters. They can listen to it as part of this interview by radio, but also we've developed a set of frequently asked questions from those informational sessions. And so the questions that were asked, as well as the responses from Dr. Troik, are on the website itself, which is part of the Chicago Lighthouse. So if you go to chicagolighthouse.org/ICVP, you'll come to the landing page. There's a section on the team members, Dr. Troik, myself, as well as Dr. Slick and other members of the team, the frequently asked questions document that I told you about, and the copies of the articles and audio tapes of the informational sessions themselves will all be accessible by way of that main website, which is really important for individuals to know that if they miss any piece of this, they can go to one central location and review any of that information.
You know, your point, Frank, about the feedback that we've gotten from our previous interactions with Lighthouse patrons and the effect it's had on the project is I think really a good one and worth emphasizing, because it is too often the case that in the development of rehabilitation technologies, there's a lack of listening to the users who will receive these devices, who will choose to get them. And for that reason, there's often a lot of disuse of the devices because they don't really fit the needs. And so really, since Frank's been involved in our project, we've had a very strong emphasis on having the potential recipients' feedback affect the project. And it has done so in many ways. It has shaped the technology. It has shaped our thinking. It has placed us really at the forefronts in this type of field of rehabilitation technology of specifically recruiting inputs from potential recipients, and that will continue throughout the project. So, I mean, what I've learned is some of the incredibly naive perceptions that I had about what people who have blindness felt was important to them, and that will continue to inform the project. So, we on our project don't see the the recipients who will eventually participate in the clinical trial as being someone that we're testing things on. We see them like astronauts who have a unique capability to tell us how, with this type of system implanted in the brain, we can affect the vision system. And it's more than just about trying to have a restoration of vision perception. It's really about understanding how the brain works.
And I think Dr. Troik's comment about how we envision the participants as astronauts is really significant, because one of the things we learned through our interaction with and interviews with individuals here at the Lighthouse is that participants in these studies see themselves as explorers and want to learn about the vision system and these types of devices along with us. And so it has resulted in us really reconceptualizing the role that the individuals, participants, will play on this project as being, you know, having the opportunity to communicate information to us that they think is important, but also as, in a way, junior co-investigators, where they're learning along with us about these devices as well as the impact that it has on vision. And I think that's really significant in terms of looking at other projects in the vision prosthesis field. Would you agree, Dr. Troik?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that too often, I know you and I hear these presentations and we think, gee, you could have just asked the people and they would have told you. So, yes, the astronaut analogy is something that we adopted in this project early on, because we do see this as an exploration, and we do see that the recipients who will be participants in the study are truly part of the research team, just in the same way that astronauts are part of the space program.
And, you know, on a personal note, as someone who is blind, for me it's very remarkable, you know, looking at this process here, working at the Lighthouse and getting to look firsthand, first of all, at the educational component and basically seeing how this project evolves. You know, I know that when I was growing up, it's something that, you know, maybe we saw in movies, you know, about what the future might hold as far as vision restoration. So, you know, on a personal level, I have to say I am, you know, very honored to be a part of this project. And, you know, I myself and, you know, my other blind colleagues, you know, we are thrilled to be able to provide feedback to your team.
Well, you're not alone in being inspired by movies and science fiction. We all are. And so, you know, we see the Geordi's visor, we see the things in our science fiction, in our stories, and they inspire us.
Yeah,
and so it's nice that we're all inspired together.
Well, you know, this has been a great, great interview, very informative. Is there anything else either of you would like to share?
No, just again, I think it's important for individuals to understand, again, chicagolighthouse.org/ICVP/ is really the hub of information here, again, located very strategically here at the Lighthouse as part of the Lighthouse webpage, where individuals can go and have access to any of the information about this project in terms of where we're at right now. And also, if individuals are interested in attending the next session on July 8th, they can call the main number at the Chicago Lighthouse and ask to speak to Patricia Rodriguez. And she will go ahead and put individuals' name down. There is a cap on how many people can attend, because the room in the senior center can only hold 40 people. Mm-hmm. And so it's important if you're planning on attending that you contact us ahead of time and let us know. Give us your name so we can hold a place for you.
And we were filled up last time.
Yes.
Yes, it was to max capacity, which is great. That's wonderful. All right. Well, Dr. Lane and Dr. Troik, thank you so much for this wonderful interview. I know that we're out of time, but it was all very, very informative and interesting topics.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes. Thank you, Sandy.
That smells good.
Well, look who came out of his man cave. Game must be over.
Oh, babe, just checking on you and dinner.
Well, your stomach clock is fast. It's going to be a while. How about some celery?
Nah, that's rabbit food. There must be something good in here.
Well, why don't you...
You okay?
Oh.
Honey!
It can happen anytime, any place, without warning. Fact is, 2 out of 3 people with diabetes die of a heart attack or stroke. Many don't even know they're at risk. The good news is, if you or someone you love has diabetes, you can lower the risk. But it's up to you to ask your healthcare provider how. For more information, go to diabetesactnow.org. That's diabetesactnow.org. Brought to you by the American Diabetes Association and the Ad Council.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to the Beacon on this Saturday morning, which it looks like it's going to be a wonderful day, at least compared to what we've been used to.
Crazy. I think in 15 years that I've lived here, it's never been this cold this late in the year.
Yeah, I've never remembered it snowing this many times in April.
Right.
You know, there's a song that Prince wrote, Sometimes It Snows in April.
I heard that the other day.
Well, maybe I always play it when it snows in April on Chris Radio.
There it is.
But I only played it once because I don't know how many times it snowed. It's more of an accumulation, I think, than we had last November. But
it is like
almost
it, right, mm-hmm. right. Well, I looked at my weather app this week, and it looks like it's progressively getting warmer.
Yeah.
So you know, I think we're looking at maybe the low 60s by the end of the week.
Yeah, cross your fingers, cross your toes. And you know, hey, Lainey, we talked about this several shows ago and haven't mentioned it since, and I don't know why. But it's time for the 8th Annual District 1A Lions Helen Keller 5K Fun Run Walk.
Wow.
And that's going to take place rain or shine. The race is still on. It's a day of fun, fellowship, and great exercise. And it takes place Sunday, April 29th. And Richards High School.
That's next weekend.
Yes, indeed.
Get your running shoes out, friends,
mm-hmm.
even though there's snow on the ground.
All proceeds will benefit programs assisting people who are blind or hearing or visually impaired, including those offered by the Chicago Lighthouse. So proceeds, some of which will come to the Lighthouse. But did you know, and I did not know, that the Lions Club is the largest service club in the world?
I believe our dear friend Bill Jurek had mentioned that.
Yes.
On multiple occasions.
He was a proud Lion. 1.4 members.
Well, 1.4 members. It's huge.
1.4 million
members. Ha ha. Busted you.
And so what we did, we caught up with Lion Frank Carrar, and he talked a little bit about the run, and this is what he had to say.
The event's kind of special. It is held in a really pretty venue. The area is at Richards High School in Oaklawn. You start out on the track, which surrounds the football field, so we start in the stadium. We run halfway around that track, and then we leave the stadium and go on out into the Wolf Wildlife Area. So it becomes a cross-country run with ponds and ducks and geese and bridges and hopefully some beautiful sunshine along the pathway. It winds around the this course, ends up on street, comes back, goes back into the course, and then eventually ends up where we started, in the football field track area where we end the race at a 5K venue, 5K run. It's really kind of neat. We get somewhere between 150 to 200 participants every year, and lots of businesses sponsor our. The wildlife area is located about 107th and Central Avenue in Oaklawn. We have on-site registration starting at 7:30. The race begins at 9:30, so there's a two-hour window of opportunity. If people want to register ahead of time, they can register on our website It's www.lions1a-us.org. Okay, that's www.lions1a-us.org. And they can get the registration online. I think there's PayPal and so on available for that. Or they can call Lion Chris, who is our chairman, Lion Chris Coleman. Lion Chris's number is 708-785-5726. Or they can call me. My number is area code 708-636-2165. We get out, besides the runners and walkers, we have 50 to 80 lions and groups of volunteers that come out to help us, act as rangers on the course, hand out food and drinks, which is part of, you know, the thing that we do. We have a DJ to play music. The mayor of Oaklawn usually comes out to start the race. He has for the last 4 years, so we're hoping she'll be back again. The fire department will be on site to help with any medical issues, and the police, obviously, will be dealing with us on the roads and blocking up the traffic and making sure we're all safe. So we have total cooperation, and this community is great. It really is.
So there you have it, Lion Frank Carrar. It takes place Sunday, April 29th, and you should have a lot of fun there. And for more information, you can contact Lion Chris Coleman. His number is 708-785-5726. That's one good thing that's happening. Another good thing is the Off Actor, and I'm just wondering, what story will you regale us with today?
Ooh, it's always a mystery. Today we're talking about a mom of five who tried to end her life after a devastating loss until a pastor randomly reawakened a childhood dream of sending her to law, of her going to law school. So this is a pretty hard story to hear, but then it has a happy ending. So just hang in there, friends. Hang on. Aisha Champs is a single mother of five who has overcome some of the most devastating losses. But then one afternoon, a fateful phone call from her pastor, she is now fulfilling her childhood dream of becoming a lawyer. Champs had wanted to be a lawyer since she was 7 years old, but she had a rocky upbringing, and as a teenager just was in with real rough crowds and had a real rough life. She did not have any stable guidance at the time. Her mom was addicted to drugs. Her father had passed away, and she was homeless, living with friends, sort of sleeping wherever she could, wherever she would be taken in. And then she got pregnant with the first of her five children, and sort of history just kind of took over from there. Champs eventually found stability by dropping out of high school and landing a job at a call center. Then at the age of 24, when she was pregnant with her fourth child, her house burned down. She lost her job. Her mother died of a stroke, and the father of her children passed away of cancer. So this all happened when she was 24 years old. The devastation eventually became too much for her to bear, and she did try to take her own life, unsuccessfully, fortunately. Shortly after her suicide attempt, she received a serendipitous phone call from the pastor of her church, and she, the pastor, Pastor Louise Holman, called and said that God had told her to tell me to go back to school. This is a quote. God had told her to tell me to go back to school and get my GED because that lawyer I wanted to be, I will be it. So this was the pastor telling Champs that this is the message that she received. Champs thought it was a little crazy because she was old and had three children. She was not old. She was 24, but she felt like she was too old. She had three children, was pregnant with a fourth, and she had actually never told her pastor about her childhood dream to become a lawyer. So it was sort of this divine intervention that for some reason her pastor got the message that she had a childhood dream of becoming a lawyer. So despite her initial apprehension, she re-enrolled in school and acquired her GED. She then took classes at Houston Community College and then started attending the University of Houston downtown. And finally, after years of hard work, the 33-year-old mother is now due to graduate magna cum laude from Texas Southern University's Thurgood Marshall School of Law in May, which is outstanding. As a means of celebrating, she posted a series of photos with her five mini lawyers, her children, and she credits them with her success. She says, I took the pictures with my kids because they helped me through school. They would help me review with flashcards while I cooked. They would sit as a mock jury while I taught them what I learned that day. I would sit in my closet and pray and cry because I was overwhelmed. And my oldest son, David, would gather his siblings, give them a snack, make them take a bath, gather their school clothes, all to make things easier for me. And he had she had no knowledge that he was doing this until she actually went to go do it and saw that it had been done for her. So all her babies helped facilitate her graduation from law school, and through an incredibly tumultuous 24 years, well, 33 really, because then getting her GED and her undergrad and then her law degree with five children is no easy task whatsoever. So I just found that very inspiring that she, I don't know if the pastor paid for her to go back to school. It's kind of unclear like how this worked, but or she just got the serendipitous phone call and felt like it was a message from the divine and decided to do it on her own. But regardless, the outcome is she's now graduating magna cum laude from her law school, and she's going to be a lawyer.
Well, she her probably, childhood dream. Yeah, if she's magna cum laude along the way, she probably picked up some scholarship.
I would hope so.
Money.
Single mom of
but
five
yeah,
kids.
I mean, that's amazing. Even without the five children, that's a difficult road.
Have I ever told you that I went to law school?
No.
Yes. Yes, I did. I lasted 1 year, and I had no children. So I don't know how she did it as a single mom with five. But bless her heart. Like, I wish her all the best, because clearly she has worked hard, and she has wonderful children who support her mission going through this, and I hope that she's able to provide just a lovely life for them that she was never able to have.
Well, counselor.
Yes.
I guess it's like that Steely Dan song, the weekend at the college didn't turn out like he planned.
That was about the equivalent of my law school career. Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's a story for another time.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so we're going to take a break, and we've just concluded the off actor, Eleni Kleeman. Great story.
Thank you, sir.
And you're listening to The Beacon here on WCPT 820 AM.
I started at the Lighthouse when I was still in college at UIC. It was 2012, and I worked here until about 3.5 years, until the middle of 2015. I never saw myself working in blindness until I worked here, and I started working with Tom Persky. And really, I had used technology and utilized blindness technology for myself. So coming here, I was able to start, you know, learning and working with technology, and really fell in love with it. The pieces were in place for the Lighthouse to work with the call center, but some of the accessibility needed to be assessed. And I was able to, you know, go through the standard training curriculum. And when I went through that, I was able, you know, to assess where the needs were and where the various pieces were that needed to be worked on. One result of the tollway project was not only to make that system accessible, but to show that we were opening doors for, you know, the future of blind people and working in and around this area. And you can take that to a national level as well. So we were opening doors here in Chicago with this specific tollway project, but we can then, you know, shift that to opening doors for the totally blind population across the country or around the world. What I really think said so much about the Lighthouse. I was upstairs in the call center, and my house burned down, but most of my personal possessions were melted. And I had taken 2 days off, which I didn't ever really take any days off. And I just, you know, I had told my boss, just that I really need to sift through everything here and try to figure out what's going on. And I came back to work, and there was a pile of money, and there was a coat, and there was just, that was my Lighthouse family was there. That was my call center. And I was the only male in that room. And it was just the best, it was such a great environment to be in. There is no way I would be there if it wasn't for the Lighthouse. I'm positive, I'm absolutely positive. Not just when it comes to work or anything like that, but just being able to develop, you know, those professional skills. I mean, the communication, the emails, the everything it takes to really hold a real job. I mean, and when we talk about employment for blind people, it's about getting into the real world and holding that salary position, and it's not easy, and I never would be there. There is no way I would be there if it wasn't for the Lighthouse. I wouldn't consider it to be a stepping stone. I would consider it to be a launch pad. It was a way for me to launch myself forward and upward in anything, you know, that I chose to do.
The Lighthouse Endowment Campaign is an ongoing campaign to help secure the future of the Chicago Lighthouse for the 67,000-plus patients, clients, and families that utilize our services each year. Historically, our endowment fund has helped maintain critical programs on the verge of shutting down, preserve jobs in times of economic stress, and meet the growing demand for vision care services among America's aging population. To make a contribution, please contact Jennifer Miller, 312-997-3643.
Well, that's going to do it for us, friends. Brian and I have been doing a lot of singing off the air today, I've noticed. We've sort of been dialoguing in song.
We should do a musical beacon.
I would love it. I would love it. Do not even get me started. You are going to eat your words because I will take that and run with it, my friend.
We'll do every segment, every interview will be sung. You'll have to find guests who are willing to cooperate with that.
I think there's a niche for that. I really do. I think we should take it and see where it goes.
Yeah.
We might lose our entire audience base, but we'll find new ones, right? We'll tap into the musical theater crowd.
We'll see.
Anyway,
folks, don't forget the 8th Annual District 1A Lions Helen Keller 5K Fun Run and Walk on Sunday, April 29th. At the Richards High School at 10601 South Central Avenue, Oaklawn, Illinois. That's in my neck.
Yeah, it is. You should get down there.
My neck.
No excuse.
If you want more information, call a Lion Chris Coleman at area code 708-785-5726. That's 708-785-5726.
Great. All right. Sounds good. Well, we are wrapping up, friends. So we'd like to thank our president and CEO, Dr. Janet Slick, for keeping us on the air all these years, year after year after year, and just being an awesome support system for us. Have a safe week, everybody. We will see you same time, same place next week. Bye-bye.